Hey everybody, this is Charlie from Anthrax, and you are listening to Today's Boondoggle.
This is Mark Metcalf, and you are listening to Today's Boondoggle with Bailey on Domain Cleveland Radio.
You are listening to Today's Boondoggle with Bailey on Domain Cleveland Radio. Yes, Kato Kalin listens to this all the time.
Monty Heath, so one Heath, and you are listening to Today's Boondoggle.
Hey, what's up? It's John from Skillet, and you are listening to Today's Boondoggle on Domain Cleveland Radio.
Fasten your seatbelts!
Sound the alarm. Incarceration Music and Tattoo Festival is back with Shinedown. Godsmack, Breaking Benjamin, Hailstorm, The Offspring, Chevelle, Bad Omens, Chimera, and so many more. Report to Historic Ohio State Reformatory this July 19th through 21st. 3 days of nonstop rock, tattoos, Blood Prison, Haunted House, and more. Passes on sale now at incarceration.com.
What's going on, everybody? It's Bill Bailey with Today's Boondoggle. And real quick housekeeping note, if you're watching us on YouTube or BitChute or Rumble or Odyssey, please hit that follow and subscribe button. And if you're listening to us on Spotify, Apple, Google, whatever podcast platform you utilize, please hit that follow and subscribe button so we can continue to bring you conversations like the one I'm bringing you today. I'm catching up with old friend, Mr. Phil Rainey. How you doing, Phil?
Good, Bill. How you doing, man?
Good, good. Yeah, we were just catching up a little bit, seeing how each other's family's doing. And, you know, I want to get into a little bit of, you know, how we met and stuff. But usually when I have people on for the first time, I like to do a quick background. So do you remember originally what you wanted to be when you grew up?
What I wanted to be when I – yeah, actually, I wanted to be a deep-sea diver. So – that, yeah, kind of came true for me.
Yeah, wow. So ever since a kid, huh?
Yeah, yeah. It was just that fascination with the ocean, watching Jacques Cousteau, and yeah, that was my passion.
Awesome. And then do you remember, like, when it was that, like, you know, you said growing up watching Jacques Cousteau kind of got you, you know, attracted to that, but when did you like make the first move to start getting into diving?
You know, I got scuba certified. I grew up, you know, in Southern California. So, you know, we would go to the beach a lot and, you know, did snorkeling and that. And then, at some point, we moved to Utah, and I ended up getting certified to scuba dive in Utah. Gosh, back in, I'd say late 70s, and then ended up joining a bridging company, Army bridging company, in Utah, and became a reconnaissance diver for them. And then they sent me to Navy dive school in Panama City, Florida.
So oh, nice.
That was my start as a reconnaissance diver. And then, yeah, then after that switched, moved to the San Diego area and joined a deep sea diving unit there out of, we were actually based out of Camp Pendleton. It was a reserve component based out of Camp Pendleton, the 294th Dive Detachment in Camp Pendleton. So,
yeah, I remember, you know, when you were sharing your story about being an Army diver and stuff, and then, and knowing, like, you know, how many, you know, how much of that takes place with the Navy, it's like, it's funny how much, what was that like being in the Army doing diving compared to, you know, when you originally were just doing certifications for fun, what was that like?
It was great. You know, it's not work when you love what you're doing. So that was my goal was to, you know, become a deep sea diver. And I thought I wanted to do that as a career. But in the Army, when I went through dive school, I think we only had about 200 divers in all the Army. That was active and reserve. And so it was a small group. And for the most part, they didn't know what to do with you. So they pretty much left us alone. And so we could get into trouble on our own.
Yeah, we had when I finished the majority of my career as a reservist, you know, I was part of a salt craft unit, and we worked with, you know, a mobile dive team that kind of, it was, I remember the same thing. Nobody knew what to do with them here in Cleveland. So left them to themselves. And then we would take them out and, you know, we'd found stuff to do.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's nice when you're in that kind of a situation.
Yeah. And then do you recall, like, before even, you know, you got involved with the Army, that calling to serve? Do you know when you felt that?
You know, I think back, and this would have been like 83, 84 when I got in, and part of it was necessity. We were in the middle of a recession at the time. And so I was out of work trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And things just kind of fell into place. And I found out that this bridging company had divers. And so, you know, so it was just one of those things that it was like the perfect opportunity for one, for me to serve my country, and two, to become a diver and get paid to do it. So, so that was a perfect situation.
Nice. And then, coming from, you know, you said you grew up in California and then you got involved out in Utah with, diving and the military. What were some of the oddest things that you feel you experienced when you came into the military?
I think, you know, that shocker of boot camp, that was an experience. It was an awakening, and you know, you grew up real quick, and worked your way through it. But going through Navy dive school, as being in the Army and being like the odd man out, and you know, that having that rivalry of being the Army dog in a Navy dive school, and that was an experience. But you know, I've always been the kind of person that, you know, when you stack the odds against me, it just makes me more determined to prove people wrong and to, you know, to bring myself up to a higher standard to be able to achieve that goal. So I think that was a driving force behind that.
Great. And I mean, you say when you do, you were saying when you you know, actually are doing something that you love, it's not work, but was there ever a time where you like were set to a place that you didn't enjoy serving at?
You know, I think the second time I went to Korea was kind of one of those things. The first time, people loved us, and it was a great place to be. And you were really welcome there. The second time, there had been an issue with the military and interaction with the civilians there, and so they didn't like us a whole lot. So that was a little rough. I just couldn't wait to get to leave that place by then. But other than that, it, you know, it wasn't too bad. I never actually, we were never, deployed into combat. I think, the beginning of, Desert Storm, we were put on, alert three times, but we're not as deep sea divers, you're not a forward unit. And so we were more support, and so never saw combat action. We did a lot of sketchy, dangerous jobs, but you know, never having someone shooting at you.
So. Yeah. And then where was one of your favorite places that you got to serve at?
I mean, just that San Diego area. So we would do our training in some really nice water, and got to be involved in some exercises there. Never, you know, the Army's jurisdiction is bays, lakes, and inland waterways. So we never got to a lot of tropical places, even though I think Pearl Harbor comes under Army jurisdiction. We never went there. But there wasn't a whole lot of really pleasurable Hobby Lobby diving other than, say, that San Diego area.
Gotcha. And then when you when it was like time to transition out of the military, what was what would you say is one of your biggest pet peeves with civilians as you were coming out of the military?
I think a lot of it was just that a little bit of it was lack of respect. I think a lack of accountability, because in the military there's so much accountability, and just, you know, trying to deal with that, you know, people's attitudes not having any accountability for their actions, or the backlash of what that might cause. So I think that was the biggest one that I had to deal with.
Yeah, I feel that. And then what is something that you feel you will always carry with you from your time of service?
I think what has helped me and made the biggest impact was knowing that you can do a lot more than you ever thought you could, being pushed to your limits or what you thought were your limits, and then being able to accomplish more and get through that better than you thought you could. So having that understanding that, you know, that you're so much more capable than what you think, especially when you're pushed to that and you're highly motivated, then yeah, you can accomplish so much more than you think you can. I think that was the big takeaway from that.
Well, yeah, for sure. And what is what's like one of the funniest stories you feel you can share from your time of service?
Ooh, yeah, there's some that I probably shouldn't share. There were some fun times. We did a dive mission in San Francisco, at the Special Services, dock there. And we flew on Hueys back then, from San Diego to Treasure Island. That was great. Because, you know, there was a fog bank in there. And so we were trying to fly under it, so we could see, and, being, you know, just pretty much following that terrain was pretty exciting. That was probably one of the coolest dive missions that, did, even though, you know, it was just when we got there, we were just inspecting a pier, but there was, yeah, there were a lot of them, but it's hard to pick one out.
Yeah, gotcha. And then what would you say is one of your greatest hopes for the country that you've been willing to give your life for?
You know, that's a tough one because it's so skewed now. You know, you look back and we go into the military thinking that we're doing the right thing, and you know, you want to defend your country, and that's what you believe it's all about. And then later on, you see, you know, what so much of it's about, and you know the price that cost, you know, the lives that were taken, the destruction and the, you know, and that's an amazing toll that has taken on our country. And so I don't know, I think that especially as young men and women, we want to do the right thing, and we really want to contribute. And especially as young men, you know, you have that warrior spirit, and you grow up that way. And so you go into it with that. And so I think trying to make some sense of that all and is really a tough one. You see the kids going in today, and I guess it's really hard to get behind that when, you know, when you think maybe it's political or it's a financial gain on some part. So as we get a better understanding of what it's all about, we hope that at some point it will be, you know, for a good cause, and you really want the best. I think for me, it's looking at our generations to come, and yeah, hoping that price that is paid is just. So I don't know if that answered that question.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm kind of, you know, I've been on the same, you know, thought process myself lately. It's like there was a time where, you know, families wouldn't, you know, people would be proud of like coming from a family of men that served, you know, and then, oh, my son's serving, or my daughter served too, and stuff like that. And I mean, I've been, you know, I've told my daughters I don't want them to, you know, with the, right, the state of affairs today. I'd rather them, you know, stay clear. And it's sad, you know?
Yeah.
But that's just kind of, like you said, you know, we come through with a different understanding. I mean, it's been several years since, you know, I've been out there and we've seen each other, you know, and I've done a lot of self-healing, and you played a huge part in that, which I definitely want to get into through our conversation. But yeah, through that time of healing and reflecting, start seeing things a lot more clearly. But speaking of some of that healing, what do you feel we can do to break the stigma of mental health and PTSD?
You know, I think we've come a long ways with that. You know, back in the generations before ours, and even in our generation, no one really talked about it. It was, you know, it was really looked down on. And I think we've come a long ways in breaching that. But I think the main thing that can help people understand is actually, how many people struggle, right? And it's what we're finding is that a lot of those issues that present themselves to military personnel a lot of those issues were actually came from childhood issues that they either buried or, you know, they were that affected them. And then they presented later on when other things happened, like a brain injury or some kind of exposure to neurotoxins. And so that's, I think, you know, just actually talking about it and understanding that has been a huge part. You know, people talk about the suicide rate, and there's a lot of thoughts on what the actual rate is, but most people, you know, say it's around 22 veterans a day that take their lives. And that's, I think, is a conservative number. I think it's quite a bit more than that, but that's, you know, that's still over 8,000 a year. If we knew that many people had been killed in combat, we would be losing our minds, right? So there's a lot more understanding that has to happen, and I think that's what has to happen is that we just continue to talk about it, and understand that it's kind of a spectrum, right? So it can vary for each individual, and it's not just you can't just lump those folks all into one little bit. We've all got our issues, right? So what might seem big to one person is, you know, is not to someone else. So we actually have to view it that way, I think, is that it's a spectrum. And so just like autism is a spectrum, you can have it in different degrees. So just that communication is huge.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. You know, it's no longer just like suck it up, throw some dirt on it and get to work, man. It's right? Like, you know, because it, you know, the body keeps the score, and you know, it'll reveal itself in other ways eventually. You know?
Right. Yeah, you don't just walk it off.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then so after your time of service, like when did you end up in Idaho?
Gosh, when I was in the reserves, I was actually spend half of my year up here in Idaho, either logging or working for my brother in the tree business. And then I would go to California. I had contracts down there that I would do through the winter. So I actually had a pretty nice situation. So so I bounced back and forth probably since 77, when my brothers and I came up to Idaho logging, because my folks grew up here in this little valley, and actually my great grandmother was born here. But so since 77, I've been going back and forth. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then, when you say contracts, was it still involving diving when you went back to California?
Or? No, I had a tree service.
Okay.
Doing tree maintenance. Yeah. So I would do that in the winter down there and spend my summers up here. So bounced back and forth. Yeah.
And then, you know, getting to like how we met, you know, I had, you know, early in my healing journey after my deployment, I had gotten connected with the Higher Ground out there in Sun Valley, and, you know, formed a friendship with Monty and a lot of the guys out there. And you know, my first exposure to Idaho, being a Cleveland, Ohio guy, you know, it was amazing how much just that change of scenery, you know, and being out in nature and the land, you know, changed my mental health and how I felt. But while out there, that's where I got to meet you and hear about, you know, your what you currently do with the hyperbarics out there, and was able to come back out with my daughters and do the hyperbaric treatments as well, which, you know, I, you know, like immediately felt the benefits of it. I remember during that time frame, there was a medication that the VA had me on called gabapentin for some of my chronic pain. And at one point, like, I didn't renew my prescription, and the VA's closed, of course, on weekends. And I went through this horrible withdrawal from that medication. And I knew it was just like, okay, if it's making me feel like what I, you know, I guess would liken it to what I've heard with people coming off of like heroin and stuff like that, with the nausea and the brain pops and the sweats, I go, this, whatever the benefits are, you know, can't be, you know, the side effects have to be worse. So I knew I needed to get off of that. And as I was weaning off it, you know, I was out there doing the hyperbarics, and it actually helped me wean off that easier and quicker than if I had normally tried to wean off here. So, and then, you know, the feelings in my joints, the feelings in my, you know, I've had compromised breathing issues since my deployment. I was feeling more energetic. I was feeling less inflammation. And that was just, you know, from the couple weeks that I was out there and got to do that. But how did you get into this? What brought you to hyperbarics, first of all?
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess what initially triggered it, my wife at the time, when this all started, she had a surgery that she ended up with a bone infection from osteomyelitis from a back surgery. And I knew that hyperbarics was really good for wound care and for healing, because what I learned in dive school, but also just some of the things that we saw. We did a dive mission in San Diego, and we were getting our tanks filled on the McKee, which was a sub tender, and they had a guy, a Navy kid in there who'd been in a motorcycle accident, lost a large section of his calf, and they were getting ready to do an amputation. And somebody had mentioned to him about hyperbarics. And so he went and to the McKee and asked them if they would treat him. And so they agreed to do that. And they had pictures on the bulkhead in there of his leg and how it healed. It just amazed me and really stuck with me. So when my wife was going through this, I asked the docs about hyperbarics and if that would help. And every doc told me, no, it wasn't an indication for it. And I just assumed that they were correct. And so didn't really think of it for a while. But then I started doing my own research and found out that actually osteomyelitis is an indication for hyperbarics, and insurance would have covered it, and it would have cut the heal time by at least half, and she wouldn't have had to be on the heavy antibiotics that she was, and so with that research, I saw all the different things that it would do and that it was helpful for, and then what the mechanisms were and the properties that hyperbarics had. So I thought, well, man, that, you know, there isn't a freestanding facility, because in the hyperbaric world, there's freestanding facilities that are not hospital based. And then there's hospital based facilities that will only treat those 14 indications and nothing off label. And so at the time, there weren't any freestanding facilities in Idaho. And I realized that, you know, I knew how to run this equipment. It wasn't rocket science. And that there were so many people that I knew that had different conditions that I could help. And And I was in my 50s at the time. And so, you know, I thought, well, it's time to stop climbing trees and maybe do something that that I could do to really help people. And so that's when I made that that leap and bought my first chamber and started the business in 2012. And so that was a big jump for me. The stars lined up and I was able to do it on kind of a shoestring budget, but and it just continued to grow from there.
Yeah, and then when, you know, like you said, you did all that research leading up to that, but like since you've been in the business and running the facility, what other kind of benefits have you noticed or recognized on the, you know, human body that, you know, modern, you know, that modern doctors will, you know.
Right. No, I know what you're saying. So one of the things is something that you noticed is that so some of the properties hyperbarics has is that it knocks down inflammation. It ramps up stem cell production. You can revasculate the body, grow blood vessels anywhere in the body that you need to. And then it's a huge detoxer, along with that. So that's where, what you notice with the gabapentin, it scrubs those toxins out, but also at the same time, it scrubs neuroreceptors, right? So we've with all the veterans that we see, they generally come with their bag of meds that the VA gives them. And whether it's for, you know, whether it's antidepressants or pain meds, this scrubs those receptors. So as far as withdrawals, you don't have those withdrawals that you would normally have. We had a veteran that was an alcoholic. He had, you know, brain injuries. He was in a tank battalion, but this guy would drink from 8 o'clock in the morning until he either passed out or went to bed. And his neurologist told me that, you know, he was going to go into DTs when we started treating him, to, you know, be ready for that, that he was going to have to be hospitalized. And he showed up intoxicated that afternoon. We treated him. He went to bed, got up in the morning, came in, and he was amazed. He said, he, you know, put his hand out, said, look, I have no shakes. I feel great. I haven't had a drink. This is amazing. I feel really, really good. And so, but we've seen that with pretty much every vet that we've treated has either completely been able to get off their meds or reduce them to the point where they don't have the side effects from those meds. And that's huge because whether it's the SSRI drugs or the pain meds, long-term use is not what you want to do with those, and especially things like gabapentin. The side effects are just can be severe and really debilitating and hard on your body. You're just, you know, you're not meant to take those in long-term use. And so, you know, we're not only treating the symptoms, but we're treating the root cause of a lot of these symptoms. And if, you know, I look at it as if you treat the wound, the symptoms go away. And so that's what we try to do. And then that doing that, it makes it durable, right? So if you revasculate the brain or heal tissue anywhere in the body, then the symptoms that you're getting from those, they will go away and it's durable, you know, it's long term, and unless you have another insult, it shouldn't come back.
Yeah, and I, you know, it's funny too, because it's like I had, you know, some knee injuries and joint injuries, and they would always be like, well, you know, if you drop some weight, there's less weight and pressure on your knees and stuff, yet you're putting me on gabapentin and I'm putting on like 20 pounds, right. You know, just blowing up with some of the medication. So it was just right. like, it was a never ending battle back then. But I mean, since, you know, that experience there started me, you know, researching and looking into other kind of like holistic ways of healing since I've been back home here and on my journey. And I'm like, you know, there's probably like two, I went from like a whole pharmacy of medications and now I'm just on like two medications now, you know, one of them was because, you know, I had a heart attack back in 2020, and that one I've changing my diet and exercising and just a lot more natural things. You know, I'm down to, you know, just like one for my heart, and that one still like, if I could keep my sugar cravings in check, you know, I'd probably be off of that one as well, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people had heart attacks in 2020. That's the thing, is that we in Western medication or Western medicine, it's kind of cost prohibitive to treat the root cause, because then you lose patients. Right.
Lose customers.
Customers. Yeah. Not. Yeah. Right. They become. Yeah. I think, you know, most people understand that. And that's why a lot of people are losing faith in Western medicine. I mean, it's got its purpose. But I think, you know, we're starting to have a different understanding of medicine and which is helpful.
Yeah. I mean, it's sad that, you know, it's like, you know, you would hope that the people and the organizations that sent us off to, you know, that build us up and sent us off to combat and harm's way would also put as much time and effort into fixing us and healing us when we come back. But, you know, for my, I mean, and you know, the VA has come a long way from, you know, from where it was, and I am still grateful for some of the benefits that I do get from it and I do need, but the majority of my like healing has taken place outside of it by seeking places like higher ground, by doing the hyperbarics with you, by you know, like places like float tanks and cryo and, you know, all these other things that I've seeked outside, and most of them, like, you know, through other veteran organizations, as veterans still continuing to help other veterans.
Right. Yeah. I think our understanding of the cost of war is not very good. I think in general, the public doesn't understand that it's not that initial cost. What we pay out to veterans in disability is huge, and then that, and then the suffering that those veterans have from then on, you know, I mean, it's big. It's, you know, we never really looked at it, even early on, you know, World War I, World War II, Vietnam, you know, Korea, Vietnam. All of those conflicts, those folks came back, and a lot of them suffered. And you know, there's a lot of suffering that goes on that doesn't get tagged with the military. That there's things that happen. You know, you're exposed to neurotoxins that you weren't before. Some of them, you know, are, you know, come from us. I saw a report on that, I think it was methlequin that was, is that the anti-malaria drug? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So there are two main anti-malaria drugs that we were giving guys before they deployed. And while they were deployed, and I think methylquinone was one of them, and we realized that, or found out later on, that it was can become a neurotoxin when it's overprescribed. It has a shelf life of 2 to 4 weeks, and you're given it every week. So a lot of these guys that were that say never left the wire, and that came down with PTSD and trying to figure out, well, why would you have PTSD? Because you never left the wire. You never saw combat. You were a cook or a clerk. And, how could that be? I think a lot of that was related to that. And, because it creates a brain injury, right? It's a neurotoxin that or can be a neurotoxin that affects the brain, and so if we look at the brain as the processor and in a computer, so it's the hardware, and whether you have a concussive injury or you're exposed to a neurotoxin, or from say burn pits or anything else that as veterans were exposed to, that's a brain injury. And so you're damaging that processor. And so everything that goes into that computer is skewed. Everything that comes out is skewed. And so that's, we're starting to get a better understanding of that and how that works and where that comes from. So that's why I think why hyperbarics works for PTSD, right? I mean, it's still a biological injury in the brain that we're dealing with. Yeah, there's a psychological component, but if you don't fix that processor, then anything that you try to do to feed that computer, your brain is going to be skewed, and you won't process it correctly. And so that's why I think with hyperbarics, being able to do that first before you jump on to any other therapy, heal that biological component. And what's nice is that while we're fixing the brain, we're working on the rest of your body as well. Your knees, your liver, your kidneys, your pancreas, every system in your body is improving because we're feeding it stem cells and we're feeding it oxygen, and we're detoxing the body and creating that environment so that it can heal properly. So that's, I think we've come a long ways with our understanding in hyperbarics in a very short period of time.
Yeah, that was actually my next question too, because of the effects of, the PTSD and like traumatic brain injury, like what the benefits of hyperbarics and oxygen are towards that, which I think you answered, but, we were talking about some of the medications that we were given before deployment and stuff. And I know this became like a hot button issue during COVID, but, even some of the vaccines that we were given before deployment, come to find out, a lot heavy metals, mercury, stuff like that. And that, affects the brain. I know some of the things that I still kind of struggle with, which is like, I definitely should try and plan another trip out, but the brain fog and memory and stuff. But I know how bad, like on top of the pain receptors, when you're in chronic pain and then you're not thinking clearly, that definitely adds to irritability and anger. And, I wasn't the best, when I came out there, I wasn't the best around with my temper and stuff, around my daughters and stuff. And just during that time, it was just during that healing, my daughters will still talk to this day about our trip out there. I mean, there was many reasons why, the beauty of the area and everything like that. But it's like, it was the beginning of like kind of getting dad back, and the healing and stuff. But what more can you share about that, the healing benefits of, you know, going in and getting a treatment and getting exposed to that oxygen? Like, what more can you share with the audience about that?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Like I say, we've come a long ways. I mean, when I started in 2012, the understanding of hyperbarics and how it worked was that, you know, we assumed that that high concentration of O2 is what triggered all the gene responses, and it does trigger some of those gene responses. Like, you know, it'll elevate glutathione levels. But it's a great detoxer as well at those high levels of O2. But the Israelis, just recently in the last few years have discovered that it's actually the when you come out of the chamber or when you go off of O2, because at 2.5 atmospheres, which is the equivalent of 50 feet of seawater, your oxygen concentration is 1500% higher than normal because you're dissolving O2 into the plasma and then from there into the rest of your tissue, even your bone. And so it's this massive amount of O2, which triggers a certain amount of gene responses. But then when you take an air break or you come out of the chamber, and say if you're in the chamber at that depth on O2 and you go off of O2, your O2 sats will drop down to 500% above normal. That's massive still. 500% above normal is big. But the differential drop is 1,000%, right? Because you're going from 1,500% to 500%. So you're dropping that that differential to 1,000%, and it tricks your body into thinking you're having trauma. So that is the main mechanism that it that ramps up stem cell production. You're right. So one treatment will more than double your stem cell production, and then it's accumulative. So you get, each time you do a treatment, you get more and more stem cells, and then which are stem cells are just generic cells, right? They go to damaged tissue and they will grow into new tissue. And so so you've got that going on, and then it has that an apoptotic effect, a self-destruct mechanism of inflammatory cells. So it triggers that in inflammatory cells. So it knocks down inflammation anywhere in the body. And we treated a lot of COVID patients and post-COVID patients because that was the main issue that they were having, right? That inflammatory response that the body has. So that information is brand new, relatively new. And so now we do air breaks. So before, when we were treating you, you were on 100% O2 the whole time, at the bottom, right, for 60 minutes on O2. Now we do 20 minutes on O2, a 5-minute air break, 20 minutes on O2, 5-minute air break, and then basically another 20 minutes on O2 as you come up, and then you go off of O2. So now it's like getting three treatments in one. And that's at our deeper depth. At our shallower depth, we don't do that when we're treating more brain neurological conditions, because you're so shallow that it doesn't have that big of a differential, so it doesn't really matter as much. But that could change too. I mean, as our understanding of the mechanism and how hyperbarics works, we adjust our protocols for our patients. And here at our facility, we tailor that to the patient's needs, right? We don't treat everybody as, well, you've got a neurological brain injury and that's what we're treating, you know, for the TBI or PTSD. We look at a full body thing. So we try to, you know, create that environment that's best for that patient and tailor it for them. So that's huge. That's a big thing on and how that works. Now the Israelis, Dr. Efferante, has been huge with this, and his team is learning that a course of treatments that they do, and a lot of facilities are starting to do this, will actually lengthen telomeres. And telomeres in the anti-aging world are, that's the kind of the holy grail for anti-aging. As your telomeres shrink, you age. And so you know, if you can, it's with their study, what it showed is that you could lengthen telomeres 19 to 30% longer. So and then it has an effect on senescent cells, which are instrumental in the anti-aging world as well. So it's interesting how we've evolved from, you know, thinking that it's just the, you know, that high level of O2 that was the mechanism. So I know it's a lot, that's a lot of information all in one, but that's what we're learning.
Well, no, you answered a lot of the other questions I was going to ask, because I remember I was out there, I think it was 2016 when I was out there, and I stayed there and did the treatments because the Cavaliers won the championship. I remember the Cleveland Cavaliers ended up winning the championship, and I was the only Cleveland guy out there, and like everybody, and you know, seemed to be a Golden State fan or whatever. Right. But you know, you mentioned the anti-aging stuff, and you look the exact same as I just left, you know, back in 2016. So obviously it's, you know,
yeah, no, I'm paying off for you. 67 now. So yeah, it's, and it's amazing. Yeah. I mean, the difference that you feel with that, my lead technician, he's 60 now. He's a former, Coast Guard aviator for about 25 years, and he looks like he's in, you know, in his late 40s, maybe early 50s, but it's nice having the access to that.
Yeah, and I got a question for you too. So in 2020, as I mentioned, the beginning of 2020 is when I had my mild heart attack, had to get a stent put in. And, you know, that's when I really had to, you know, I was making a lot of lifestyle changes, but not enough. Obviously food was still getting me, and I, you know, was still putting on weight and everything. After that, you know, I started making some changes, dropping some weight, training. And, then, you know, of course, 2020 is when COVID came as well. At the end of 2020, I actually had to be hospitalized because I had gotten COVID. You know, as I mentioned, my lungs have been, you know, haven't been the same since my deployment, burn pit exposure and stuff like that. Thankfully, I made it through the hospitalization, came home. They had me on oxygen for a little bit at home. And I was, you know, it took me a little bit to finally start getting a little bit of my cardio back, you know. I'm not where I would want to be or, you know, like to be, but I am, you know, active. I'm doing jujitsu and exercising and stuff, but it's still, I notice a difference. But what helped with the healing was having the home oxygen. And I just had the, you know, the nose thing, and I would sit there for a little bit and notice my mind was sharper as well. And I've been getting in an argument with my girlfriend about this, but I've been like, man, I'd almost like to be back on the oxygen. Just, you know, like you're saying, I don't have access to a facility like yours, but just a little bit of, you know, hooking up to the oxygen machine after or before going to do jiu-jitsu might help quite a bit. I got nervous because having the tanks in the house and like if I light a candle or something, you know, I don't know. I was overthinking it. And so then after I was feeling better, I had told my doctor, all right, you can send it back. But I almost want to reverse that and still you know, get that. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, when you're breathing 100% O2, you know, well, first off, when your lungs are compromised, right, and you have this scarring in your lungs from whatever, your lung capacity drops, right? Even if you're, you know, I mean, it's going to affect your tidal flow, how much you draw in. But if you think about that, that, you know, for an adult in decent condition, the surface area of your lungs is about the size of a tennis court. And as we age, that starts to shrink, right? So you can't pull in as much O2 as you normally would. And especially if you've had any kind of a lung condition or damage to your lungs. And so, and you've got scarring in there. What hyperbarics does is that it reduces scarring, even old scars, you know, with patients that we've treated, you can see physically on the outside, those scars shrinking up. That's why it's used in a lot of plastic surgery cases, because it can generally reduce the scarring by about 50%. And so if you visualize that in a surface area, say the size of a tennis court, and you're able to reduce scarring globally through your lungs and rebuild capillary beds and the alveola in there, right, because you're getting stem cells there to replace those damaged cells, then you're going to increase lung capacity. Therefore, you're going to be able to pull in more O2. And right, so, and then two, as far as how your brain functions, your brain lives in this ischemic environment, never gets enough O2 for full brain function, right? You get 5 to 10% of brain function, even though your lungs, the air that you pull into your lungs, that O2, 20% of that goes to your brain, right? Your brain makes up 3% of your body capacity, uses up 20% of the O2, and that's only enough to supply 5 to 10% of brain function. So there's nothing left over for wound care. But also, if you have any kind of an anoxic event, like you're not getting enough O2, the first thing that is affected is your brain, right? So that's where the brain fog comes from. Cognitive skills, you start to have issues with that. Anger issues, depression is huge, right? You're just not getting that O2 to your brain. And that's why when you go on O2, even though when you're breathing 100% O2 in the ambient pressure, like on the surface, that... the hemoglobin is the main carrying agent for O2. And so it can, each heme can pick up 4 O2 molecules, can't pick up anymore. Doesn't matter what percentage of O2 that you're breathing, it's only going to pick that up. And then the rest, depending on what altitude you are, will dissolve into your plasma. And so, you know, that's why you do better at sea level, right? Because you're dissolving more O2 in there. So that's, I think, you know, once you get that understanding of how that works, then it starts to make sense where, you know, hyperbarics, it's one, it's helpful. Like when you're doing your treatments here, you're running on high octane, right? Because you've dissolved massive amounts of O2. Now every cell has enough oxygen to create ATP, the energy source for the cell. So every cell is functioning at its peak, and then and so every organ now is going to work better. Hormonal exchange is going to be better. So that's why you feel better during the treatments, and then, you know, you go home and you feel better for a while, and then you'll feel a little bit of a sag after that, right? You feel like you're regressing. Well, you're going to go back to you're not going to go back to baseline when you came in, because you've done a lot of repair, but you're not going to have that high that you had while you were doing the treatments. And so that's going to kind of subside a little bit. But, you know, it's about healing, right? And healing, yes, that tissue and getting that to work at a better rate. So yeah, I mean, you could benefit. Yeah, you need to get out here and do another course of treatments.
Yeah, so, for sure. I'm you know, the VA has me on you know, I do have a nebulizer, you know, and I've been doing some NAC with the nebulizer, and it kind of helps clear the sinuses a little bit, you know, but I'm also on a CPAP machine at night. And right. I just recently had an issue where the CPAP malfunctioned, and it took like over a week before I could get into the VA and get it replaced. And man, I felt the difference of just not getting full restful sleep. But I've talked to some friends that have a BPAP or BiPAP or whatever, where they're getting oxygen with their CPAP.
Right.
And what a difference that has made for them. So I'm currently, you know, trying to get in with the VA doctors to see if I can get approved again for, you know, they want to do another sleep. I guess I have to do another sleep study and jump through the hoops again, but hopefully try and get that. But you know how it is. It might be like, right. Oh no, you don't need it. You're good enough without it, you know, yeah. Stuff like that. But,
it's crazy to me that, you know, the lack of understanding, of O2, and that's, I mean, I guess you get a better understanding if you held your breath, right, for just a couple minutes, you start to appreciate O2.
Right? Yeah.
You can go without food for a long time. You can go for without water, you know, yeah, but you cut off that O2 and things start to happen pretty quick. So, why it's so hard for people to understand that, I don't know, but that kind of brings things into perspective. It's just do that. And so, I mean, and that's where, you know, Otto Warburg, who was instrumental in, and got the Nobel Peace Prize for his research on cancer, was, you know, I mean, one of the main things he said about cancer is that if the cells have enough O2, that they shouldn't turn cancerous, right? That they that helps prevent that. And of course, we can't say that in the hyperbaric world. You can't say anything about being able to treat that. We actually treat a lot of patients that are recovering from cancer, but you know, if the cells don't get that O2, they don't function properly. And so, I mean, and you're a good example of that, and how you feel, right? So,
yeah.
So it's strange to think that O2 and a little bit of pressure makes, you know, can do that many things, but it's really that simple. And maybe that's kind of what holds us back, is that it's just too simple. And you can't patent it. So that really holds us back.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm definitely, going to be pushing for at least getting that prescription back home here again, for just that little bit I can get until I can get back out there, you know, for some treatments. But, you know, I wanted to switch it up just a little bit too, because before we get ready to wrap up, because my girlfriend would be mad at me if I didn't bring up firefighting. She's a firefighter EMT here in Ohio. And I remember you were a volunteer firefighter out there.
Yeah. Still doing
it. Are you still involved with that? Yeah.
Yep. Still on the department. Yeah. Yeah. At 67, I do a lot of coaching, I guess we'll call it, with the guys. I'm still running equipment and still, yeah, working, you know, on the line. But it's interesting, because these kids coming up now, I mean, could be my, not much older than my kid. And in fact, my stepson, he's a firefighter in San Jose. Just got on with San Jose Fire. So, proud of him. And my youngest, my 17-year-old, he's actually excited about, he wants to join the fire department as soon as he's old enough. So next year he'll.
What was the training like in that regards out there? Because I know you deal with a lot of nature and, you know, forest and mountain brush fires and stuff.
Right. So, I mean, we have, you know, our structural firefighting, you know, the because I'm on the city volunteer fire department. But then we also, yeah, because we're in mountainous terrain, we do wildland firefighting and training as well. So, yeah, there's that crossover that we have. But it's, you know, it wasn't that difficult of a transition to go into firefighting, you know. And it's great when you have guys that have military background that go into that industry because they have that understanding. You know, rank structure is a little bit of it, but so much of it is just, you know, your training and having the discipline to do that. It's a little different culture now than it used to be. You know, in some ways it's good, some ways not so good. I think the kids nowadays, and I hate to say it, but, you know, a little softer than back in the day. You look at that, and that's, you know, that's another thing. You look at guys going into the military now, and some of them are animals, but then, you know, there's a large portion of them that you wonder how they make it.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe meeting a quota or something.
Yeah.
But I know, because, you know, my girlfriend loves fishing outdoors and loves being a firefighter here. But I mentioned that I'd be talking to you and, you know, that you did that out there. And she's like, man, I want to go out and, you know, get some of that training as well. So, you know, hopefully maybe I'll she's been the one I've been arguing with about me being going back on oxygen, though, too. So maybe I'll have to bring her out so she can experience some of the benefits of hyperbaric as well. And then she can go out there and help you guys get some firefighter training or whatever.
Right? Yeah. 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 Love to have both of you guys. Bring the whole family.
Yeah, for sure. And the girls have definitely been on me about coming back out. And I'm glad, you know, it's like when I came home from my deployment, you know, and I was going through the separation with their mom, I made the mistake of thinking I could buy a bunch of nonsense, you know, for their love and affection and the things that have stood the test. Those things got thrown off to the side when they got right. bored with it. But the things that have stayed, you know, through the years is just the memories of traveling and making memories together. And like I said, that was still one of our all time favorite trips as a family that we still talk about. So definitely have to plan on coming back out. Phil, it's been great catching up with you, man. I really appreciate you taking the time and, definitely we'll keep in touch. So hopefully we can make that a reality coming back out to see you. But before we get ready and wrap up, I want to ask you a couple questions I normally ask my guests on the show. What is the last book that you read?
Ooh, the last book that I read. Gosh, that's, you know, that's a tough one because I think most of the reading I do now are studies. I don't have a whole lot of time for that. By the end of the day, I'm like ready to crash but always in the interim, I'm like medical journals and studies. I don't know, you know, it's fascinating to me and just staying on top of things is important with this. So, yeah, I wish I could tell you, but it's been a while.
Yeah. Gotcha. And then who are three people who've inspired you and you can credit for making you the person you are today?
Three people. Well, two of them are my brothers, have made, you know, I've learned a lot from both of them. I've got an older brother and a younger brother. And so, you know, of course, as kids, we didn't do a whole lot of listening to our our siblings. But, that was big. Who would be another one? Gosh, there's so many. I think a lot of folks that seem to make a difference. Actually, there's a book that I read a long time ago. It's not necessarily a person, but the person that wrote this book had a lot of wisdom, and that was Jonathan Livingston Seagull. And it kind of puts things into perspective on life and, you know, what it's all about and, you know, learning lessons on kindness. And I think, you know, if you put that in the forefront, that you know, a lot of what we do would change. You know, that perspective on life is being kind. I think that made a huge change in my life, just understanding that. But now that's a book that I read, but it was a long time ago. But that, that I think, you know, that author, and I can't remember his name right now, but that made a huge influence on me and kind of set a path for me and what I do now. Because yeah, it's as a job, it's, you know, it's work, but it doesn't fatigue me. I love doing what I'm doing and it's rewarding and, being able to help people and see, the results like in a very short period of time. And some of them, you know, respond, you know, right on the first treatment. And so that's a huge benefit for me.
Yeah. And then we were talking a little bit about the new generation coming up a couple times during this interview, but what class do you feel should be mandatory before graduating high school today?
Oh yeah. That's a good one. 'Cause I just ran for school board, didn't make it, but yeah, I'm really concerned with what's going on in the schools. A class that should be mandatory. There's so many of them that they're missing, but maybe a big one would be, you know, back when we took social studies, right? And we studied the Constitution and what that was all about and what that really meant. I think a lot of us kids now are missing what that was all about and how our country was built and the founding fathers, what their vision was and what that was all about. I think maybe constitutional law or the Constitution, I think, you know, should be at least one class that everybody should know and understand that concept of, you know, where we are as a country now, where we used to be, and what it was all about. So I think that would be, yeah, my main thing.
Yeah, agree for sure. And then any message you have for our military members that are currently serving overseas?
Message, yeah, be safe. You know, you got to cover your own ass. You know, that's take care of yourself, number one, and don't believe everything you hear. But, yeah. And that there are, you know, I mean, doggone it, it's so hard, it seems, to get the message out that there are treatments for these guys with PTSD and TBI and, you know, and never give up, you know, but, you know, reach out. There are people out there that want to help. You just have to kind of take that, you know, when you get out, even before you get out. You know, we've treated guys that were active duty, and you know, they didn't want anybody to know that they were being treated. But you know, the sooner you can get help, the better. In fact, that's something that they should be doing before they even get out. You know, this I feel like the, if we did this for every veteran that had that, you know, was getting out, you know, with PTSD or TBI, is that you don't get out until you go through the course, get treatment, because it's life changing, and there's no reason to suffer. The you know, fact that we're not, that the VA is not offering it, and the DOD isn't involved in it, is just mind boggling to me, but it is what it is.
Yeah, I agree. And then for anybody out there that's listening to this, you know, especially any veterans, but you know, anybody that's interested in hyperbarics or trying it out and want to you know, follow what you guys are doing out there at Sun Valley, or maybe want to, you know, set up and fly out and try some, where would you send them?
Well, I mean, they could, you know, they could look us up, but here at Hyperbarics of Sun Valley, we have a nonprofit that that we try to pay for these guys. But there's the Mission 43, well, for Idaho veterans, we'll cover their costs, but there's a lot of facilities around the country. There's another one here in Idaho, in Pocatello. There is in Virginia, if you're on the East Coast, there's a facility outside of Virginia Beach. I think it's called Rhodes Hyperbarics. I can't remember exactly, but Sarah there is a great source. And yeah, I, you know, if you went online and punched in HBOT, which is hyperbaric oxygen therapy, and veterans programs, or TBI, PTSD for veterans, that you'll find places out there that people can go to, and a lot of different organizations are funding it. America's Mighty Warrior funds for special operations guys. There's there are several the Green Beret Foundation, Task Force Dagger. There's a lot of other ones out there. Not near as many as there should be, but Treat Now Foundation is a great source. And in fact, if you contact them, they can usually connect you with a facility in your area to get treatment.
Awesome. But, yeah, I'll have to look into that myself. Phil, like I said, it's been great catching up with you. I do want to, if you could hold on as I shut this down, I do want to run something by you off the air, but, it has been awesome catching up with you on the show and sharing all your information, man. And, I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Anytime, Bill. Appreciate the contact.
All right.